Good morning to all of you. Welcome to the January morning session of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. I'm Mike Pirtle from Omaha, and I'm pleased to be joined today on my right by our Chief Judge Frankie Moore from North Platte, and on my left by Judge Dave Arterburn from Papillion. We have five cases this morning. We will take them in order. I know we have at least one juvenile case. If there are things of a confidential nature, because these are being streamed and archived, you might want to use first names only. With that, I will call the first case, and be patient with me. We're always asked to call the case name twice for the streaming of the video. So our first case this morning is Yates versus Casto. You may approach. Again, our first case is Yates versus Casto. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Gail Bolivar. I represent John and Denise Yates.
Counsel.
What I'd like to do is ask this court to address a very specific and significant issue, and that is, was there a breach of fiduciary duty? I think the court is going to conclude that there was. There are three elements that I'd like to address, if I have time, and that is the fiduciary duty standard. That has two elements, I believe. That is a common law in Nebraska, long-standing fiduciary status, essentially saying there's a superior and inferior relationship between parties, here specifically in an investment advisory capacity. Secondarily, when the investment advisor changed his status in October of 2012 to go to an investment advisor, he himself changed his status to a fiduciary duty, because that is what an investment advisor has as a duty. Secondly, I think their standard of negligence was breached, and that was from Mr. Casto, the investment advisor's own testimony. Thirdly, I think damages are given. Again, Mr. Casto testified that the appropriate portfolio was a 60-40 or 50-50. Frankly, they're not that far apart in terms of outcomes once you enter the market, and therefore the damages are certain in my view.
There appears to be a dispute, according to the briefs, as to what our standard of review is.
I noticed that, Your Honor. I believe you'll resolve that. I don't know that there's much I can say. There's just a difference. I believe it was equitable matter. The defendant, Ms. Buter, believes it's a legal one. I think that's a legal issue, and you all will decide that. I don't want to spend my... Well,
the relief you request is monetary.
Pardon me?
The relief you requested was monetary.
It was. Moving ahead, fiduciary duty. The investment advisor met the clients in July of 2009. I think that's significant. It's past the 2008-2009 disaster that we recently had. And what was he presented with? A 45-year-old and a 52-year-old. And once a person retires at, let's say, 65, a person could have 30 years beyond that of life. So the portfolio had to be set up for an extensive period of time. Recall that this money was not money that was just earned. It was money from Mrs. Yates' position had been inherited. From Mr. Yates, it was 20 years of savings. The initial portfolio, which we stipulated to and agreed to, was acceptable. It was a 60-40 portfolio. It performed well. The Yates were pleased. After a year, Mr. Casto decided to change it. What did he do? He bought an annuity. He already had an annuity. He could have left the product in the annuity, added money to it. He did not. Why? Because as you look at Exhibit 1, which was this large document, you saw in this three phases. There was Phase 2 and Phase 3 that bought initial annuities that was unnecessary. There was no reason to buy initial, except for it puts money in the pocket of the investment advisor. Because what did he buy? He bought an annuity, and then what did he select out of 100 possibilities? He selected fixed income.
Excuse me, Mr. Bolivar.
Yes.
So this was in 2010 you're talking about, change.
It is. That's
and
correct.
Wasn't there some direction from your clients to make that change?
No. Recall that standard throughout, the investment advice, the investment objective of the client was future retirement income. Never changed.
But at some point, didn't they express concerns about the market?
No. The only person you heard that from was Mr. Casto. Recall
well,
that
but
Mr.
But there's evidence to that. He testified to that.
Mr. Casto did.
Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Casto did because he had to. There's no other way he's going to get by with doing what he did except to ask them to sign documents, which they signed. Mm-hmm. And then you would say to me, well, didn't they sign information? They certainly did. Remember, early testimony was Mrs. Yates writes them after they've committed more than $500,000 and says, we don't know what we signed. Is there any doubt that there's a fiduciary relationship here, that there's a senior level of knowledge and a subordinate level of knowledge? Frankly, the Yates had no knowledge about investments, so how could they indeed be worried about anything, because the worst crisis had passed, and therefore they had 30 years that they had to rely on somebody to put together a portfolio that was going to be good for them for the next 30, 40 years. And he did. It didn't make him any money. Once you make a sale, buy and hold. Hold doesn't get you any money unless you have a percent of assets under management. That annuitizes the income for the broker, and most of the time it's beneficial for the broker. In this case, I would suggest that all of the discussion about they changed their attitude was not supported by Mr. and Mrs. Yates. They said, and we get clogged up here.
Was it supported by some of the documents?
Well, of course it was. How many times do you think Bernie Madoff gave documents to people and said, you know, we want investments, and they signed off on it and said yes? The signatures, I think, violate two things. Because if you only look at signatures, I wouldn't be standing here, wouldn't have went to court. But you got to look at the reason for the signatures. It was the superior relationship, putting in front of somebody saying, trust me. Let's take this in the medical situation. You go to your doctor, you say, I need some medicine. Do you say to your doctor, I'm not going to sign off on that script that you tell me I need that medicine? No, I suggest to you. You listen to them. How many people go home and go to their PDR, physician's desk references, where you find all these drugs and look it up and say, what's good for me? We don't. That's not the society we have today. The society we have today is a specialized mechanism. People go to lawyers, they go to dentists, they go to doctors for specific information. So I suggest to you that what he did was just part of his overall interest in selling product. They signed off, they had signed off of it and said, we're going to shoot you tomorrow. They had signed off. They didn't know. That's the essence of the fiduciary duty. A superior relationship, a subordinate relationship, I think in spades. You see that when you read the information. I hope I haven't said this already, but Mrs. Yates writes the next day and says, I don't know what I signed. Annuities are complex instruments. She never knew that an annuity had a life insurance component. Who does? I would suggest nobody knows that, because annuities are complex. And there you have the factual background.
Since this was a bench trial, trial judge was the finder of fact, and he obviously, as I recall, three-day trial, correct?
That's
listened
correct.
To the testimony, he reviewed the documents, and he made a credibility determination here.
He did. I love that question, because I love that decision. He says, well, based on this, I look at Mr. Castro, and he gave them what they wanted. Really? Really? This is a fiduciary relationship. Is the answer to that, I go to my doctor and a doctor gives me some medication and it's inappropriate, and it's, I wanted that medicine? That can't be the standard.
But so, if the doctor testified, I gave the patient the appropriate medication, and the court finds that to be credible, what can we do?
Well, what we can do is we can look at the facts from the testimony of the investment advisor. What did he say? He told you, because I asked him, is a 60-40 appropriate? Yes is the answer. And what did they end up with? 100% fixed income. No growth. 3% growth from that point forward, because it wasn't going to get any better.
But his testimony was he made those changes based on the instructions from his customers or his clients, right?
Based on somebody that didn't know something.
They were concerned about the market.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
They were concerned about the volatility of the market.
There was no volatility of the market because they were in a fixed income product. So that was bogus. That there was fixed income. He also said, well,
they were concerned
more choices.
While
there
were
100 choices.
His testimony was they were concerned when they were still in the 60-40 about the market.
Remember?
And he assured him it will go up and down and you're fine. But they wanted to change.
Remember, I asked him. I said, didn't the variable annuity part get taken away because of the life insurance? Yes. So it should have never happened. Recall, the industry standard is you don't look to what the client wants, you went to what they should be given. That's the fiduciary standard in Nebraska. He knew what they should be given. They should be given a division between equities and fixed income, which is what he first gave them. And that was standard throughout. It still is standard today.
So you're saying he should not follow their request?
Absolutely. He's the doctor. He's the person that has the knowledge. They have none. To say, as the court
so
did...
So if he'd have kept them in the 60-40 and their accounts tanked, there would have been no liability?
Absolutely. We would not be here today. Thank you. I reserve 2 minutes. Now 52 seconds.
Thank you.
Counsel? Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Mr. Bolivar, my name is Victoria Buter, and I represent the appellee Stephen Casto in this matter. I'd like to start just by briefly addressing the question from the court regarding the standard of review, because there is a dispute in the briefs regarding the standard of review. As the court has noted, this was a case where monetary damages were sought. There was no equitable relief as such sought in this particular matter. As the court has also noted, this was a 3-day bench trial. And following that 3-day bench trial, the district court issued a ruling from the bench where he made various findings. Those findings, in short, are that the appellants failed to meet their burden to prove the breach of fiduciary duty and negligence cases, that Mr. Casto was a credible witness, and that his testimony was supported by the documents that were received by the court, that the appellants here gave informed consent to each and every investment transaction that they engaged in throughout their time with Mr. Casto, and that the district court gave little weight to the expert that was presented by the appellants. In denying a motion for new trial, the court went a little further and also stated that not only did he find Mr. Casto credible, he found the appellants not credible. In short, in a bench trial, as I think the court has noted, the factual findings of a district court are entitled to the same deference as a jury verdict. And that means that those should not be overturned unless the findings are clearly erroneous. In addition, as a trier of fact, the district court stood as the sole judge of the credibility of the witnesses in this case. And we submit that the record overwhelmingly supports the factual findings of the district court. I would like to address a couple of points that were raised by Mr. Bolivar. First of all, with regard to the 2010 change, and I think the court has already looked at the record and has seen this, but in 2009, Mr. and Mrs. Yates came to Mr. Casto and he did put them into a 60-40 type portfolio. One set of annuities on one side and a managed account on the other side. In 2009, Ms. Yates did send an email and said, hey, we're a little confused about a couple of things. That was taken care of. Mr. Casto cleared up those issues to the extent that Mr. and Mrs. Yates both testified at trial that they were absolutely satisfied with their portfolio in the 2009 and 2010 time period. In 2010, the testimony and the documents support the fact that Mr. and Mrs. Yates went to Mr. Casto and said, we're happy with what we've done. We've seen some gains in our accounts. We'd like to keep those gains. We want to get out of the market. We do have some concerns. Those concerns were actually supported by documents that were put into evidence by the appellant's expert, where it showed a downturn of about 11% in the equities market in 2010. Mr. Casto testified that he actually told the Yateses, you know, markets go up and down. They, you know, you can ride this, you've got some time. They really wanted to get out of the market, and so Mr. Casto put them into a Jackson National annuity. Within that annuity, because it was a variable annuity, they had the ability to move. They were able to, within that annuity, stay in a fixed income if they were concerned about the markets, but they had the ability to move those funds into an index within there that was more tied to the equities market if they wanted, in the future, to be exposed to some additional risk. That was fully documented. Mr. and Mrs. Yates signed documents and initial documents that set forth all of this in front of them. There is no accusation here that somehow something was forged or something was altered. There's a reference to that in the briefs, and we would submit that there's nothing whatsoever in the record that would support that. In 2012, there was another meeting with Mr. and Mrs. Yates and Mr. Casto. And in 2012, Mr. Casto actually proposed that he could rebalance their portfolio to allow it to have some additional growth and be exposed a little bit more to the markets. Mr. and Mrs. Yates, despite the fact that we've heard testimony that they don't know what's going on, they actually rejected that recommendation by Mr. Casto and decided to keep their portfolio as it was. In 2013, 3 years after the 2010 transition, by that time, Mr. Casto had, in fact, decided to drop his Series 7 securities license, and he was only an investment advisor. And at that point, he disclosed to Mr. and Mrs. Yates that he did not have the ability to service their Jackson National annuities anymore because they were variable annuities, which are securities, and he could not do that. He gave them three options at that time. He told them, first of all, go find a new advisor. These Jackson annuities are good. You should keep them. Find an advisor who can actually service those for you. His second option was to put the money back into a managed account. That's something an investment advisor can do under the securities laws. His third and final option was to the possibility of an additional annuity. Mr. and Mrs. Yates considered those options, came back to Mr. Casto, and decided to make the change from the Jackson National Annuities to the security benefit annuities that you've heard about.
Was there any evidence that he was already contemplating letting his broker's license go at the time that he got the Yates into the Jackson investments?
No, there was no evidence of that at all. The first time that he dropped his licenses was in 2012. He did so voluntarily, by the way. They weren't lost. It was not a force. But no, there was no evidence that there was anything or any sign of him thinking that in 2010.
All right.
I'd like to briefly address, there was a comment made by Mr. Bolivar that the only reason that Mr. Casto did this was to enrich himself. First of all, with regard to that, there is a commission that is paid on annuity transactions. It's not uncommon. It happens all the time. There was no testimony at trial to suggest that the commission he received was excessive or somehow deviated from industry standards. And Mr. Casto actually testified that had he taken the money that was in the annuities and put it into a managed account where he was receiving an annual 1% fee, he would have ultimately earned more on that money than he received from taking the commissions on the annuities. Now, there's a statement in some briefing that that's not correct, but there was no evidence of that during the trial. There was an opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Casto on that particular point, and that did not happen. The only evidence is that he would have actually received more. So we submit there's nothing here to suggest that Mr. Casto did this to enrich himself.
And which investments? There was something about, there were certain investments, but the commission was paid by the company, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Which investments were those?
Those are the annuity investments. So the way that annuities work is the company actually pays the commission to the registered representative or advisor. Or insurance agent, in fact. Some of these can be sold by insurance agents. Ultimately, this money did not come out of the investor's pocket. They received the full value of their annuities. Now, they chose to surrender their security benefit on the advice of another advisor, so I'm sure they testified there was some surrender fees, but that was not on the advice of Mr. Casto.
Thank you.
And I'd like to just very briefly address the expert opinion that was put on, because I think Mr. Bolivar mentioned some damages here. The expert we submit, there were serious issues with his qualifications. He had held a securities license for a mere 3 years. He held an insurance license for less than a year. And he held these even prior to the Nebraska Annuities Act coming into effect in 2006. But I think more significantly, when you really look at his opinion, he didn't actually offer any opinions here. He was asked twice in his direct examination to opine that somehow there was something unsuitable with regard to these investments, and he did not do so. He offered no opinion of unsuitability with regard to the investment recommendations of Mr. Casto. He didn't opine that there was any violation of the Nebraska Annuities Act. He actually testified he didn't know the current state of the insurance laws in the various states at the time he testified. With regard to his damages, again, we would submit he really didn't offer an opinion. He simply stated that had you put Mr. and Mrs. Yates' money into a certain portfolio in 2009, it would have ended up at a certain number. But he didn't really offer, we would respectfully submit, any kind of opinion there. But even if you were to take it as opinion, we submit there are significant issues with it. It's unreliable. It ignored, he did not read Mr. Casto's deposition prior to ultimately rendering his opinion. He did not know what conversations took place between Mr. and Mrs. Yates and Mr. Casto in connection with Mr. Casto's recommendations. And he ignored, most significantly, the fact that Mr. and Mrs. Yates were happy with their 2009 allocations and retained the Aviva annuities that you've seen referenced in the briefing all the way, at least through trial. And instead of that, he ignored that, and he decided that starting in 2009, these investment recommendations should have been different. And so we submit there are serious speculative issues with regard to the damages that were asserted. And unless the court has any questions, we respectfully request that the court affirm the findings of the district court.
No. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
How much time do we have for rebuttal?
50 seconds.
Okay. Mr. Bolivar, 50 seconds.
I have 5 points for 10 seconds. First of all, it is true that an insurance company does pay the commission, but if you surrender the product, the customer pays, and that happened continuously. The product was continued. Remember, he said the reason for the change is because you get a bonus. What he didn't tell the folks is that bonus takes 10 years to vest, so they didn't offset each other. 2012, there was a meeting, and recall that the investors said, we were hoping for more growth. But they didn't realize, which tells you their knowledge, they didn't know there would be no growth. That product they were in was 100% fixed income. Fourth, recall that FINRA had two occasions when Mr. Casto was caught doctoring documents. That should send a great message. The message right behind you. Eyes and ears are poor witnesses when the soul is barbarous. Think about the situation here.
Again,
doesn't that apply?
Again, wasn't that a credibility call for the court?
To me, it was obvious in the documentation. You don't need credibility when the documentation says what the documentation says.
Okay. All right.
I'm sorry.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you
both. We'll take the case under advisement, and we appreciate you being here this morning.